Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where our job is to help you build visibility, professional credibility, and connection with your ideal client by putting the human at the center of innovative marketing, so you can build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship with your ideal clients. I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm honored that you're here with me. If you haven't joined our wonderful marketing transformation community yet, go to innovabiz.co and collect your free gift as well. Do subscribe to the show and also leave a review because it helps others find us. Let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
I think it's having the courage to go for deep truths, the courage of probing, the courage of admitting them to yourself, and the courage of reflecting them back to the people that you're serving. That's how you're going to stand apart.
Welcome back. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. If you haven't yet listened to my recent conversations with Jonathan Green of Serve No Master and psychologist and executive coach Richard Orbay Austin, then do check them out, but only after you've listened to today's conversation, of course. I'm really excited today to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest Rebecca Arbona of Brand True, a firm dedicated to brand strategy with a focus on new brand creation and naming. Rebecca lives to help brands communicate the truths at their core so they can leap from tall buildings and crush their villains. She's always been a word geek and, as a kid, read the dictionary for fun. But she somehow ended up with a career in brand strategy. So when Rebecca realized that naming combines her love of words with her talent for brand strategy, it was like a radioactive spider bite that unleashed her superpower. She's now a strategic namer and a new brand creator, crafting breakthrough names and distinctive brands that help her clients' businesses fly. In our discussion today, Rebecca talked to me about the three levels of truth: surface truth, social truth, and self-truth. We talked about the importance of niching down your service and your client. And she shared with us information about alignment of brand with strategy and with the entire customer journey. Without further ado, then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Rebecca Arbona. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today from Cincinnati, Ohio in the USA, Rebecca Arbona, who's the president and chief truth teller at Brand True, and she's an expert in helping companies develop their brand voice and strategy. Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Rebecca. It's a real privilege to have you as my guest.
I feel equally privileged. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
Kevin Perlmutter, who was our guest on episode 280 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, introduced us and suggested that we have a conversation with you. So big hello to Kevin.
Likewise, I was very grateful that he did that. He and I worked together at Interbrand many years ago, and he's a great guy.
Yeah, yeah. And he's very prolific on my LinkedIn feed in commenting on the various episodes. So thanks for that, Kevin. Big shout out. Now, you help brands to communicate the truths that's at the core of their whole existence, I guess. And one of the things you say, and I really love this, Rebecca lives to help brands communicate the truths at their core so they can leap from tall buildings and crush their villains. She's always been a word geek and as a kid read the dictionary for fun. That's really interesting, but somehow ended up in a career in brand strategy. Now, one of the things you said in some of the information you sent us before the episode was that smart work is about getting more strategic, looking around and seeing what is the right and maybe different thing to do, not just the thing that's always been done. And it has to be right based on your brand and deep truths of your brand. So a lot to unpack there, and yeah. a lot there around brand and truths and values. So tell me, how did you kind of come to this realization, and how did you go through that journey of realization that now inspires what you do?
It's a great question. So I've been working in brand strategy for over 20 years, and I've been out on my own for about 4.5. But about a year and a half ago, after I'd been doing it for a while, I changed my company's name to Brand True because, well, I had always wanted that name, but I was struck more and more and more that what got me really excited about doing brand strategy work was not just there's this sort of hollow sense of it sometimes of creating these models and moving things along in shapes and all these complicated things where you get into debates about the brand essence versus the brand truth versus the brand, I don't know what, and is it an equity pyramid or is it a brand on a page? Like all this process stuff I felt was getting in the way of truth, the truths that would allow brands to connect deeply and meaningfully with their audiences. And the more that I simplified it but focused in on truth, the more I felt like, wow, the work is getting better. And also what I do that might be different from my competitors is getting simpler and simpler to communicate. And so in that journey, as I was thinking deeply about truth, I realized that truth isn't like a light switch, like a yes or a no. We tend to think of it that way in the sense of, are you lying or are you telling the truth? But I think that there are levels of truth. And I think that this is really helpful when we're thinking about brands. The first level, what I call the surface truth, is, you know, here we are, we sell cupcakes. You know, this sort of announcement of category, of geography, of price. And you see a lot of brands that never get past that. Airlines tend to live there, you know, this is what it is. But of course, I mean, Kevin spoke so much about emotion. His business is so much about emotion. There's typically in that first level of truth, not a lot of emotion. So it is necessary, but I don't feel it's sufficient. There's a next level of truth that might be sufficient depending on your competitive position, which I call the social truth. It probably needs a better name. I'm still working on it. Mm-hmm. But that's where the brand really, really focuses on their audience. We could say customer, we could say consumer. I like best of all to say people, people that they serve. And that's really, really important, where you get to some deep stuff about the emotions that motivate them, about why they're in the category, about, although they're in the category, what are their needs that aren't yet met? You know, where you start to really unpack that. There's a lot of power there. For some brands, that might be enough if you don't have a really crowded market. I mentioned airlines. Southwest, I think, is really, really fascinating in the US. I know that's not as well known in other parts of the world, but in differentiating themselves, not talking so much about just price, not talking so much about, you know, kind of quality of experience, which is easy to talk about, but not really what anyone actually experiences. But instead, they found ways to differentiate that start to get more emotional, and they start to be more about the consumer, the people that they serve. That third level is the hardest to get at. It's the place that requires a lot of courage from a brand. And I call that the self-truth, meaning if the second truth is about those people, this is about the brand itself. This is about why. This is about heritage. This is about a different approach, a different philosophy. So this is where you start to go really, really deep. And this is where, in my work, it can be hard for brands to start to talk about this. And yet when they do, there's a lot of power there. I'm trying to think of examples that I can share. This is really, really proprietary stuff to talk about a brand where they are in these places. But I'll say that that when you get to some of these deep truths, oh, I thought of an example. When you get to some of these deep truths, they are not necessarily things that you say back to the people, but they are things that you understand and leverage them. So a very general but very powerful example, I've worked with lots and lots and lots of clients over the years that serve mothers, right? All kinds of brands where the target is a mom. And there's a truth, just about anyone serving this audience will tell you that if they do any kind of deep psychological work, that as much as moms want to be the best mom they can be, a super deep motivator, perhaps the deepest motivator, is appearing to be a good mom. Not being a good mom, but appearing to be a good mom. Now, this is a deep truth that if you were to say it back, that's disaster. Yeah. I call it poking them in the eye. If you say to them, well, we know what you really care about is looking like a great mom. That's like, ah, you poked me. No, I never said that. Even though they, with certain kinds of research where you're really getting to deep motivations, they might have said it, but they'll deny it. But if you know it, you think about how you present things visually, maybe some admiring moms looking on. Yeah. Maybe some, words of support, right? If you know it, you can leverage it. That's deep truth. The passion that you bring to your brand, we had to be this microbrewery because we wanted to lift up our community and we had this recipe, this vision. You know, when you start to get to that deep stuff, that's when, especially in a crowded category, I understand who they are. I understand why they're different. I understand why they're for me.
That's fascinating. That it's triggering a whole lot of thoughts in my mind. It mirrors very much the first couple of stages that we do in our marketing journey, which is really starting with a lot of self-awareness, why you're in business, why you're doing what you do, why you're in business, what drives you, and then who it is you serve, and then getting really clear on the people you serve around. And we do things called empathy mapping to build an empathetic and emotional connection. So I never really thought of it as branding, but this is what you're describing right now.
Absolutely.
I've got a question for you, and this is a challenge with a client that I'm doing some of this work right now, and we're going through the why thing, and I was thinking I've got to do this 6 or 7 why exercise now. And I said, well, why are you in business? Because I'm good at what I do. Okay, well, but why do you want to actually share that information with your audience? Because I'm driven to share it. And I'm thinking it's all surface level. And I did say to her, I said, if it doesn't bring a tear to your eye, we haven't got to the why yet. How do you approach that sort of situation?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one, right? I would go back in time with her. You said it's a woman. I would go back in time. You're an intelligent, talented person. You're very good at this because you invested time in being good at this, but you could have chosen many things to be good at. Why did you go down this path? Why were you born to do this and not something else that with your gifts you could have done? I would try that. And I would try getting her not so much to comment and analyze, but to relive moments. Where were you when you realized that this is what you wanted to do? Tell me about that moment. What was going through your mind? And get her in that space and then say, and why was it that you knew it was for you? Because you're engaging her rational mind and she's, a little bit defensive, a little bit guarded, maybe, which is understandable. You know, the interaction with you is business world. And emotion and business world, we are often taught, shouldn't be mixing. You and I both think they should, but that's really hard to overcome.
That's right. Well, I looked at what I'd written down on my form, and I thought, oh God, I haven't gone deep enough on this. I thought I need to do the exercise on myself. And yet you know, I was thinking as you were explaining the process as well. I mean, when we named our business, we just did a haphazard exercise of sitting around the kitchen table and throwing out hundreds of names and brainstorming. And I think InnovaBiz was one of the first ones I threw out as an idea. And we thought, oh, yeah, that's a bit ordinary. And then went back and looked at it and it was the first, it was the, we went back to the first one that we'd probably written down and said, oh, well, actually that encapsulates it. But when I then reflect back on all the things that that represents and everything that's underlying that, there's a lot of what you said in that, and yet we didn't go through the process. So is that just luck or happen chance, or is it something unconscious going on?
I think it was unconscious because you didn't go through the process, but you circled back around to it. You had selection criteria, maybe not overtly spelled out, but they were in your head when you were looking at the names. Mm. I want to go back to something you said. Your process asked a question of me that forced me to go deeper in a wonderful way. I was gobsmacked. I can't remember exactly what the question was, but in the wonderful, thorough, delightful questionnaire that you send your guests, Jürgen, to prepare, you said something about what motivates you. I don't know. Somehow it hit me differently. And what I realized is that I really love to be a brand strategist because I love solving puzzles. That's not the deep one. I always knew that one. And I thought about it and I thought, why do I like to solve puzzles? Why? You know, the why underneath the why. And it hit me that I love to be right. hopefully not in a jerky way. Like, I don't have any problems with being wrong. I will say, oh yeah, no, that was wrong. I'm sorry. Let's go back. So I don't think I'm trying not to curse. There's a bad word I want to say. I'm not that guy who doesn't want to admit they're wrong. But when I'm right, I got it. I cracked it. That's super, super motivating for me. Mm. And to understand that, just like, you know, the mom that wants to be seen as a great mom, to understand that, that might not be something that I talk about overtly, but I'm going to remember that. I'm going to think about that. I'm also going to think about who else is motivated that way. For example, my husband loves to read mysteries. I think reading mysteries is the same thing. Like, I want to crack it. I want to know that I got it right. So I think that's maybe that's a universal motivation, but I've just been thinking about that a lot in the last few days. I also wanted to talk about your naming question. You know, we've been talking about how I'm a brand strategist. We haven't talked a lot about the fact that my business is actually quite specialized in creating new brands and naming them. And so with naming, one of the things that I realize more and more and more is that there are names that I love. I talk about them on LinkedIn, but there aren't really good names and bad names in and of themselves. They're all about how powerfully do they align with the strategy, with what's important for you to communicate. So, goodness, it's like I can't think of other examples. I'm going to come back to my company's name again. That name, Brand True, I was really avoiding having brand in my name at first because all kinds of brand strategy firms have brand in their name. And so I thought it was a big yawn and I wanted to be more interesting. I wanted to be more differentiated. But what I've told clients for years and I realized about myself is that usually you're naming things with a dynamic tension between being really descriptive, saying exactly what it is, and being unique. Typically, if you say exactly what it is, there's a lot of other people whose names sound similar. And what I decided was that the way I'm competing, I'm leveraging people I know and people who know people I know. It's not that important to be as differentiated in that first grasp of the name. It's more important to be really clear in that first get about the context, the fact that it's branding. So I chose to go with a name that, you know, I've worked in a lot of places that brand is in the name, and yet here I am with another name that says brand. For you, it might have been something similar where you said, you know, there are names that are more clever, perhaps on your list. There are names that I'm prouder of the wit of them. But the fact of the matter is that InnovaBiz, snap, just like that, you get it. Mm-hmm. And that was important to you for a podcast, for people to completely have transparency about your meaning of what you do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, I certainly I have to put my hand up and admit I was definitely wanting to be clever, and I definitely had that feeling of I want to be seen as being really clever. Wow, isn't that business clever? They've come up with this really fabulous name. So
yeah, so, we've all been there.
So I probably fell into something, failed in that, but fell into something that was maybe more sensible. Okay, now you talked about the three levels of truth. So let's dig a little bit deeper into how you explore that, and what order do you kind of explore them? Do you start off with the easy one, the surface truth?
Definitely. You do need to begin there. You know, where are we competing? What are we offering? Whom do we serve? That sort of starting point is very much, you can't get anywhere by starting in the middle. You have to start there with a lot of facts. But so much of what you see out there is people thinking that that's sufficient, people thinking that, you know, to be businesslike is to talk about what we do and not to talk about the chest thumping passion behind why we do it. And so it's like peeling an onion. That's the outer layers. That's what people are going to see first, but it's not necessarily going to get people to really remember you, connect with you, any of that good stuff that you need.
And are there examples where you'd say that it's enough to be at the surface level?
Yes. Yes. If you're the first comer, if you're the behemoth, so if you're creating something that's new to the world, it might be helpful to be extremely descriptive. In the United States, we have a retail chain called The Container Store, which sells various lovely little boxes and ways of organizing your home. And that is the biggest of those chains. Of course, retail is rough always and now extra with the pandemic. But that is the biggest of the stores of that kind. And from what I can tell from my research, that was kind of the first one to come along specializing. They've had competitors over the years that have had increasingly emotional names. And that was what was important to set themselves apart. So The Container Store, then there was Hold Everything, which is sort of saying the same thing, kind of clever, but you know, what are you going to be if the Container Store already exists? Containers and more, containers are us, right? So they went to Hold Everything. And then there was another competitor that came along, Organized Living. Now, highest order of all to say, what we're selling you is not little boxes, containers. What we're selling you is a way of life, a feeling, right? Unfortunately, in this example, not all examples are like this. The first comer, the Container Store, is the one that's still around. To actually have three competing chains on a national level all selling little boxes did not work out. But they had the first mover advantage. They had the super clear name. And certainly, when they came along, if they'd been called Organized Living, probably no one would have understood what you could get there, right? Like there was sort of a progression to become more emotionally grounded in the category. I would say that, you know, you see that with someone like Walmart, where they're now a global retailer. Their name and their positioning are not terribly emotional. They're just kind of category killer price. And that works really, really well for them. But when someone like that already exists, you're not going to come along and compete by being more of the same. And so the very successful retailers that do compete with them, like Target, again, my examples are so US based, I apologize. That name takes you to a little bit different place, talks about being more focused, talks about being a little bit more differentiated, right? That name is also visually reinforced by a logo that is what the name is, right? All those things help them. But if they, you know, we actually had Kmart, I think before Walmart. In any case, only one remains standing between Walmart and Kmart. That's not differentiated, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting because I was thinking we do have a container store here. In fact, I've been in there and purchased stuff from it. And the idea of organized living kind of, to me, says something slightly different. Even if, you know, I got a catalog organized living with all the different containers, I might be tempted to go in then. But it kind of suggests that if I'm looking to just go in and dabble around, leave me alone, I'll find the ideal container for me, which is sort of what I did with the container store. You know, sometimes I'd find this spot or have these knickknacks lying around and think I need something really specific to put those in, but you know, it's something completely different. So I'd go to the container store and there'd be all these different containers there. You could wander around at your leisure and inevitably I'd find something I'd, oh, that'll do the trick. But I didn't want anybody come and talk to me and try and sell me organized living, which is kind of what you think from that name, that there's somebody going to tell you, you know, that there's an advisory service that goes with it almost.
Right. I mean, I'm not sure everyone would go there, but that's where you went in your mind. That is the danger when you make the container larger and you can put more emotion in it. You can also put more interpretation in it. So it's not to say that very specific, very kind of first level truth sorts of names or sorts of marketing messages are bad, but they are just typically not that differentiating. So for the container store, if they still had a lot of competitions very specifically in their realm, they could be paying off a little bit more emotional positioning with, say, the other things that they do after the name, because the name can't do it all.
So what are some of the typical mistakes people make when they go about branding or picking a name for their brand or for a product? I mean, this applies to an individual product within a business as well, doesn't it?
Sure. I mean, I think that the very first thing with naming, the first mistake is to fall in love with a name. So in our naming process, we do not give our clients a name. We will generate, as you did in naming your company, we will generate hundreds and hundreds of names. And then we will typically, we'll have some very clear selection criteria agreed on with the client, very, very strategic. And we'll use that rubric, you know, that yardstick, to take probably about 10%. So say we generated 800 names, we'll probably take like 80 and start to figure out 80 that we think are most strategic, the best fit, and start to figure out, does anybody else have that name? Does anybody else have something that sounds like it? If they do have it, because there's lots of times that other people have the name, but in very unrelated categories. So do they have it in a different enough category that it's still okay? Is it unsavory? If it's a children's product and there's something that's, you know, alcohol with a similar name, it doesn't really matter that it's quite different. It's not good, right? So going through all that process, we will Google it, but we will also check on Amazon because sometimes someone's selling something under that name and it doesn't show up elsewhere. We will check something called the Urban Dictionary because certain words have names such as street drugs that you would never guess. And oh my God, it's a really bad thing. You know, we will just check in so many different ways. We will check linguistic meanings in other languages, especially if they're, you know, really relevant, like a country that has a large immigrant population from a specific country, we'd better check how that name comes across. Yes, does it mean poo?
About different languages, because I've got a story that I'm not sure I can share it here, actually, because it is an R-rated
right.
show, but it was a really bad naming of a product. And we had to wonder why, when we did presentations on that product in some countries, why we'd be laughed at, why people were laughing. I said, this is
right.
Serious. Yeah, it's not.
Right. I mean, some real disasters can happen. I once worked on a naming project for a pet company, pet foods, pet treats. And there was a real focus on love. And they were hoping for a name around love. And so all of the names we were generating around love, when we started looking at them, it was really like triple X rated. The things we were finding, we were like, I wish I could not know what I just learned. It was just horrible. But imagine if we hadn't done that work before we presented them to the client. So you asked about the biggest mistake. Okay, so we will take that, you know, say 10% of the list that we think they're strong, and we'll start going through, we'll go through. But we don't do that to find the name that we recommend. We do that to find the 15, 20, 25 names that we present. And then we'll work with the client to say, hey, what are the five or six names that you like the most? What are the five or six names that you feel, yes, I could live with this? And then you take it to the lawyers and you see what clears. And in large part because of all the vetting that we've done, when they take it to the lawyers to see if it clears, there should be out of those five or six, two or three easily that clear. And yeah, then maybe you'll have some heart-wrenching decisions to make, but do not try to pick a name at the beginning of the process. Because then so many people have come to me to say, to our company to say, we've been trying and everything we like, we can't get it clear. But they'll pick one, they'll get excited, and then their lawyers will tell them no. And then they'll pick another and they'll get excited and their lawyers will tell them no. And it's really heartbreaking. Yeah. You can't look at it like that.
And a very time-consuming process, I imagine, too, that way.
Yes, yes, yes. And time, no one ever has time to do that.
Okay, now, one of the things, brand equity is a really big thing, and I know you consider that in your process. With thinking about longer term also and the time frame around that, and then how do you do underneath a brand name, how do you bring new products in? How do you innovate around that? How do you, for example, in today's day and age where a lot of businesses are pivoting because, you know, they've been doing a lot of their work in person and now they need to pivot to online or to a different business model so that they can still survive through this social isolation period. Why is it important for brands to think about those things right up front in all that naming process and picking their brand?
Right. I mean, why is for all the reasons you just said. We don't have crystal balls, but if we do name without room to grow between the success scenario of being able to expand beyond our initial offering or the, I won't say failure scenario, the not initially successful scenario of having to pivot, either way, you could really be in a world of hurt. So it behooves us, you know, it's certainly something we say to our clients, does this name need room to grow? And remembering that sometimes with room to grow, you're giving up specificity. Again, that's why I say there's not really such thing as a good name or a bad name. You have to think about your strategy. And so, you know, as you think about what it is you're trying to accomplish, then that helps you understand what is the shape, what is the direction that you take the name.
In terms of the strategy, so, I mean, a lot of people start a business and they have a strategy. They do the strategy work and then they probably consider this brand name or business name in the context of that. What about, because that strategy changes over time and often very rapidly, because as they start the business, they learn a whole lot of things and they think, oh, hang on a minute, we've got to make adjustments pretty quickly here. And the other scenario, of course, is adding new products or services. So what's your take on, you know, adapting to that and then perhaps adding new products or services and how they fit into the brand? Do you name each new product or service for its own, like the consumer model, for example, where let's take Nike and each of their shoes has its own name, each model has its own name, or do you do it different?
Yeah, I mean, this is the part of naming that sometimes it's called nomenclature or naming architecture, where you want to understand, do you plan in advance to have a line of things that are named so that they're recognizably together? Do you not care about doing everything ad hoc? So here, a great example is actually Apple. So Apple, they started down a path where there were all Apple-related names like the Macintosh computer. That's a variety of Apple. And when they came out with a small tablet long before the market was ready, they called it the Newton because, you know, the apple falling. Yeah. Okay. All right. So they went that way. That didn't work for them. But then, you know, they had the I hyphen thing, right? So it was first an iMac and then it became an iPod. And then there was the iPhone and then there was the iPad. So that's one kind of nomenclature. And they went down that path and that, you know, whether or not they planned in advance, I don't know, but they had a whole architecture around naming there. They also had an architecture around naming their operating systems where they had like cats and then they had like, I think Western U.S. national parks or something, right? So they're trying to have a system, right? Instead of just having, say, numbers. You see it with car companies a lot too. Do they have a system for naming models within the brand? All this to say that it's not, there's not one answer, right? But what's the most helpful thing to do is to try and take a moment to think about, hey, suppose we're wildly successful and we're expanding. Do we want to pick a name, an approach, right, that would give us that room? Or are we just going to say, you know what, we don't see that, we don't have time. Okay. And then you figure it out later. And there's great stories of, you know, success without having thought about it in advance, and great stories of thought about it in advance. You had a system and it didn't really matter. You know, it's not that there's one answer. Generally speaking, strategy and planning and having room to grow is going to be helpful. But as much as I'm a strategist, I'm not going to pretend that that's the only thing driving success, you know?
Hmm.
There's still, did the people buy?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, your second level and third level of truth is all about, you know, connecting, emotionally connecting with yourself and allowing that emotional connection then to grow with your future customers, with other people who, you know, might be helped by your product or service, which is, I think that's at the core of good marketing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and I know that your listeners are very much in the innovation space. One of the things that we've done a lot of work with our clients over the years is not only innovating in a kind of if we build it, they will come sort of way, but also thinking about, does this innovation fit with this brand? Or is this a fabulous idea that we have to pursue outside of this brand because the equities don't translate? And that's another place where it's not just like yes and no black and white answers. There's also taking a look and saying, you know what? This innovation can live in this brand, but we have to do these other innovations first. We have to broaden the shoulders of the brand. The brand can't sustain that yet. And so as we think about this brand, we understand that, you know, we can go from this chewy candy to chewing gum, and then we can do something else, but we can't do something else until we've done the chewing gum. You know, like, what are the steps to get there? What is that progression? That time horizon is not always thought of in innovation. People just sort of say, can the brand support it or can it not? Well, brands grow organically over time. Their innovations create room for further innovations by expanding the understanding of what the brand can be. And so to think about that time horizon can be super, super powerful.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And of course, you know, that means you have to be really longer term about your planning and have some sort of containers around what direction are you going to take products or services in.
Yes, or have the discipline of saying, we want to make this now. This doesn't fit under the brand. The easy way is to make it a line extension, but it's going to have more success not as a line extension. Yeah. And, you know, do we have the resources to do that? Hey, do we license it to someone else if we don't? Because we want that hit of revenue now. Like, those are the sorts of disciplined, courageous decisions that I think, brand-driven decisions that I think are a part of innovation that sometimes get forgotten. We tend to think of innovation simply as the idea, but the brand home for the idea is a really, really important part of commercializing innovation.
Yeah, so it really the brand and the brand values become part of the strategy, don't they? So
absolutely.
You talk about self-truth and social truth, and I'm guessing that that uncovers values, but what's the importance of being really clear on the personal values of the people in the business and the business values, and then living those values as part of the brand? Because I think that helps inform those decisions, doesn't it?
Absolutely. What is the importance? And thank you. It's a gimme question. It's important. What I would say, though, that I think in terms of mistakes people make, is that I think people kind of like first level truth the values. They say what we value is honesty, integrity, value for money. And it's like, oh, come on now. That's like, you know, you're not telling a lie, so it's a truth. Okay, it's a truth. Okay, it's a value. But what are the values that are beyond the, you know, we don't suck values? What are the values that are differentiating you and that are driving you? If you think, you know, value for money is unique in your category and the way that you show up in the category, then I want to hear about that. But if it's just like, yeah, that's right, we have a good product for a fair price, and everyone else does too, that's not your value. You know, so that sort of thinking of, come on now, let's do that work and dig down deep, I think it applies to values as well. What's differentiating here? What's really real? Go down, go down, go down, go down some more.
Yeah, keep asking why, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the question I had on the form that you answered the wanting to be right to was what drives you. And it's interesting because it's such a simple question on the surface, but if you really think about it, you say, okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great example of it. Of I had one answer, which I didn't even put down, but there was one answer. What drives me is to, you know, help my clients make their brands as strong as possible. Sure. Check. Okay. Yeah. And then underneath that was, you know, solving the puzzle. All right. But how are we going to make, you know, these things line up? And how are we going to really talk to some consumers and get some deep answers out of them and figure out how the brand connects? Okay. We're getting somewhere with that. But then I was like, no. But what really drives me is when I do that and I go, oh, we got the answer. Yes. We solved the puzzle. Yes. I was right. That's when I really had to admit, maybe I'm a jerk, but that's what drives me. I want to be right.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I mean when I say that sometimes these deeper truths, they are a little bit more uncomfortable, or they take a little bit of courage to get into. I once did a project. So much of what I do, I have to think, can I talk about it? Once did a project for an analgesic company. So, you know, pain relief, that was turning up some really deep truths when we talked with consumers around the fact that there are some positives to this pain as well. Like, we all know that pain is bad and we want to avoid it, but in certain circumstances, it's not so bad to have this pain for a little while to sort of buy you a respite, buy you a little rest. Well, the client just could not understand how they, like, why that was something that was good for them to know, or how they could work with it or anything, because pain is bad. Yeah, pain is bad. But how is it fitting into someone's life? We can't shy away from the truths if the people are telling us that this is out there. How can we find our courage to capitalize on that? You know, how can we find the courage to maybe not sound like everyone else? By understanding what's going on at a deep level.
And also then talk to those clients at a level that they say, oh, yes, you get me. It's like I've had a few meetings where the clients come back and said, it's as if you're reading my mind. And when they say that, you know, I've had it probably about three times now, and when they say that, That's great. I've nailed it. That's like my I was right moment.
Yes, yes. I was going to say that. You were right, Jürgen. Yeah.
Because I think, okay, I've connected with them. I've connected with them at a level where they feel understood and they feel heard. And that I think that's really key in this whole getting down to this deeper level, and the brand can represent all of that.
I'm so glad you said that, because you're 100% right. That's the point of doing the work and showing the courage to get down deep. Because when we get down deep and we connect with people, that's when they're going to care about our brand more than they care about another, right? So my friend Kevin Perlmutter that we opened up talking about, I listened again. I listened at the time, and then I listened again a few days ago to the podcast that he did with you. And he was talking a lot about the importance of emotion. And I thought, well, that's what I deal with too. How can I talk about something? I don't want to sound exactly like Kevin. And I thought, the thing is, in the length of conversation that you guys had, you talked about the importance of emotion, but you didn't talk about how you get there yet, right? Like the conversation didn't go that far. That's what I'm trying to articulate. How you get there is because if we say to people, the brand should be more emotional, I think it's a very easy to predict reaction. How? Where? Well, when? You know,
should I laugh more? Should I cry more?
Right. Which emotion?
Yeah.
And so as we understand, you know, making decisions, by the way, we haven't even touched on this. Those decisions might be narrowing decisions. They might be not choosing to serve everyone in the category. But, you know, say I said something about cupcakes before. Say it is cupcakes that I sell. There's a lot of people already selling cupcakes. But if I come along and say, these are gluten-free cupcakes, well, even that's pretty well served now. But if I say, these are cupcakes that are okay for diabetics, well, there's a lot fewer diabetics than there are cupcake eaters. But you could have a fabulous business because the diabetic cupcake eaters aren't being served, but the cupcake eaters are, right? So there's courage in that as well. A lot of businesses would do well to be significantly more focused, and that's how they're going to get their emotional connection with their consumer. But we tend to think that our business should serve everyone. We're going to succeed by serving everyone. Not necessarily. If we can connect more meaningfully and with more emotion to a smaller group of people, we can have a fabulous business in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I love that. And that's such a great example, because I was thinking, in fact, I jumped to diabetics straight away as you were explaining it, as you were searching for the next level down in market. And I thought diabetics. And then when you said diabetics, I thought, well, what would, and I'm not diabetic, so I'm just imagining this. So for those people listening that may be diabetic, please come back and tell me what it is. But I'm thinking that the specific cupcakes for diabetics may not taste as good as the others because they don't have sugar or they don't have other things in that diabetics can't have. And so if you had, these are cupcakes specifically for diabetics, and they taste as good as normal cupcakes or as the best cupcakes that are out there, then you've really niched down and differentiated.
Well, 100%. I'm sorry if I gave you the impression that I was just casting about for examples. Actually, I was thinking of a very specific example.
Okay.
And I posted a video on LinkedIn today, the day that we're recording, not the day that this will run, about this. I have a friend who a year or two ago was diagnosed as a type 1 diabetic, not type 2, even though she was an adult. And it was devastating and scary for a lot of reasons. And she's a fabulous baker. And she actually could not live without baked goods, she realized pretty quickly, and started learning and experimenting. And she developed incredible baked goods, not just cupcakes, but lots of delicious treats. And I think that there's real pay dirt when you can resolve a contradiction, when you can say, oh my God, bad pun, have your cupcake and eat it too, even though you're diabetic. Or you can say, you can have this and that, that you did not think you could have at the same time. I can give it to you. That is so powerful as a marketer to offer that, to resolve a consumer contradiction. And she didn't set out to have a baking brand. She has a day job that she's not walking away from, but she could, I think, bake 10 times as many of her baked goods and successfully sell them because, you know, in Cincinnati, Ohio, with lots of wonderful bakeries, that diabetic or people that for other reasons don't want to be having sugar, don't want to be raising their blood sugar level when they eat baked goods, she is offering them something that not very many alternatives exist for. And so that example was really top of mind for me.
Okay.
I think that's a really important thing when we talk about connect to emotion. We don't just want to say connect to emotion. We want to explain how. And one way of how we connect to emotion is by going more focused, going more narrow, going to subgroups, going to underserved audiences, and bringing them solutions to their problems. You didn't think you could have this. You can. I'm going to give it to you. Nobody should go and open another bakery that doesn't have a way of being special, doesn't have a way, you know, of standing out.
Yeah. Well, that's a wonderful example, and I'm glad it's actually real.
It's very real.
Yeah. All right. Well, this is fabulous, Rebecca. I think, you know, I'm watching the time here. We've had so much fun, and we could go on talking for ages and digging into brand and strategy and how that fits and niching down into markets where we can differentiate and actually serve a need at an emotional connection level. But I think it's probably a good time on that high note with that lovely example to move on to the buzz, which is our innovation round. And it's designed to help our audience who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field with some tips from your experience. So I've got five questions, and hopefully you'll give us some really snappy answers that will inspire the listener to go and do something awesome today as a result. So what do you think the number one thing is anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Sorry, but it's not number one thing. It's number one and two, really interrelated, to have more courage and to have more discipline.
Love it. Yeah. More courage and more discipline. So more courage to dig deeper and understanding why you're doing what you're doing, and then discipline to focus on being consistent with your brand.
Exactly.
All right. What's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
I think that I'm going to sound like a broken record, but really understanding brand fundamentals, if it's developing ideas in the context of an existing brand, and in either case, whether or not there's a brand, really understanding that quantity breeds quality. Just, you're not going to be choiceful and strategic and really think and be careful and avoid making mistakes and get anywhere. It's got to be idea, 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 idea. Just quantity of ideas will lead to more success in coming up with great ideas. Just get out as many as you can.
Mm, yeah, I love it. And having done that at the beginning of my business, I think, you know, even though I said that InnovaBiz was perhaps one of the first ones, I think the fact that we came out with so many different ideas kind of highlighted that one as the one we decided was best at the time.
100%. And I know you want a lightning round, but I just want to add, and then that discipline that I talked about in the previous question, that comes in evaluating the ideas. But, you know, if you're saying to develop new ideas, what's the best thing? Develop tons, more than you think you need. Keep going until your eyes are bleeding. That's the best way to come up with great ideas.
Great. All right. Do you have a favorite resource you use most often? Apart from the dictionary that you've read.
Well, you know, I mean, when I was thinking about this, I think you asked earlier a favorite tool or system for innovation or improving productivity. I had a secret weapon of mine that I wanted to share with your listeners, which is the Full Focus Planner. It's a planner that I know is sold outside of the US too. It's a little bit of a productivity guru, and I'm not deep into his thoughts overall, but his planner is fabulous. It's just, it's how I organize myself. It's pretty wonky, pretty disciplined, but you're setting your goals at the beginning of each quarter. You're looking at them constantly. You're setting three things for the day. I don't want to sound like an infomercial. I don't have any connection to that company, but this thing, I've been using it for about a year and a half. This thing has helped me accomplish so much. That system.
Yeah, I think I've come across the Full Focus Planner. I just don't remember exactly what it looks like. Is it similar to Franklin Covey used to put out planning systems where you started off with values and then set goals, long-term, short-term goals, and then you broke those down into tasks and then you put those in the calendar and you kind of journaled the day. So all of that was part of it.
Yes, but I had that kind of training too 20 years back. And to me, that system was too involved. Like, I don't have time to sit down and plan my system to then live my system. I think there's lots of fabulous planners out there, and you have to find the one that's the fit for you and your style and maybe the time you have available. And probably the Full Focus Planner is too much focus for some people, and maybe not enough focus for a Franklin Covey person. But for me, it's a real nice sweet spot of forcing me to think about things that I maybe without that structure wouldn't go revisit my goals as much as often, wouldn't have so much clarity.
Okay, well, I'll take another look at that, and we'll certainly have a link in the show notes. Now, what's the best way to keep a project on track?
I think that the planning, I love this question, the planning and the documentation going into a project should be very, very thorough, you know, sort of, and then in week three, we're going to be doing this. And in week four, we're going to be doing that. And really understanding what your process is and planning it out in advance is the first half of the answer. And then the other half of the answer is stay on top of it with, you know, really great documentation. We're actually a little bit behind. We're actually a little bit ahead. This is what we're going to do, so that you don't sort of discover you're off the rails when you're, you know, a mile off course, but that you're like, oh, we're 3 feet off course. Everybody should know it. Are we okay with it, or are we pulling back? Right. So documentation on the front end, and then really disciplined kind of tracking and communication as to where you are. I think that's how you keep a project. That's how I keep a project or a client on track anyway.
Yeah. And that's great advice. I mean, I particularly love the documentation. I tend to, you know, be very much in the implementation phase a lot of times, and I forget to document stuff, and, you know, you tick off, oh, that's done. And then sometimes you think, oh, how did I do that? I need to go back and revisit or analyze what we did there. And then there's not enough documentation. So you have to relive that whole experience, which takes time, and simply to understand what were the steps that we did there.
And you know, that's why the word discipline comes up a lot. I mean, I'm not going to pretend that I'm always disciplined, but I know that the more disciplined I am, the better things work.
All right. So we've talked quite a bit about this, but what do you think the number one thing is anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
Yeah, I think you know what I'm going to say. I think it's having the courage to go for deep truths, the courage of probing, the courage of admitting them to yourself, and the courage of, you know, reflecting them back to the people that you're serving. That's how you're going to stand apart. There's very few categories that aren't really crowded. That's how you're going to stand apart.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, you've elaborated a lot on that and how you do that in the brand and how you actually come to those truths. So you didn't disappoint me in what I was expecting.
Well, thank you. You didn't disappoint me. I'm just really, again, so grateful and so honored that you had me on. This was really fun.
Well, this has been fabulous, Rebecca. Now, where can people reach out and get in touch with you, find out more about you, and maybe even say thank you for what you've shared with us today?
Well, you know, one of the things that I talk about is we used to talk about in business location, location, location. That was about, like, where is the shop window where people can see you and find you, right? Location on the high street so people could find you. My shop window, my location is LinkedIn. I really drive my business and my dialogue with people on LinkedIn. So it's Rebecca with one C. That's how you spell Rebecca in Spanish. I'm from Puerto Rico. So Rebecca Arbona on LinkedIn. There's just the one. Find me there. Also, my company, Brand True, is on LinkedIn and our website. But really, I found it so fascinating. The website is kind of a check the box sort of thing for my business. It's really LinkedIn, where people find me, where I find people, where we're going to engage, and where I'm sharing lots and lots of content that, you know, hopefully your listeners will find it engaging, enjoyable. A lot of people give me really great feedback about the stuff I share. So check me out there. Yeah. And say hello. Come say hello. I'm always talking with the people there.
I'm finding LinkedIn. It's interesting because a lot of people are saying there's a lot of spam on LinkedIn too, but I'm finding I'm pulled right out of Facebook, and LinkedIn is the place where you can actually have those conversations where you can engage with people and start to build relationships. And I'm stripping things out of my website all the time. I'm sort of going more and more minimalist. I figure, you stress so much over what can I put on this page, and I've got to have a service page, and I've got to outline everything I do to build credibility, and I'm pulling it all back. Of course, I've got the podcast, so there's heaps of content comes from the podcast, but I figured, you know, the building of the relationships, that's so much better on LinkedIn.
Right. I mean, if you think about that know, like, trust kind of progression to build a relationship, I think it's very, very hard to get anyone even to feel like they know you, let alone like and trust you through a website. But in a medium like LinkedIn, where, you know, here's what I think, here's what I look like because I post videos, here's me answering your question if you ask me one, we're going to get a relationship. We're going to get further on that know, like, trust continuum and much more quickly. So for me, it's absolutely the centerpiece of my business.
Now, before we started recording, we were kind of brainstorming an idea that I had in terms of setting up a masterclass with my podcast guests, where my podcast listeners would have exclusive access to that masterclass and they could learn something that was in the guest's expertise. And you had a suggestion for that. So explain to us what you think you could add value in that 1 hour masterclass.
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking about it a lot in this discussion, and I also do share a lot of content around it, but I was envisioning a strategy of naming brands masterclass. I do a lot of teaching. I've taught, you know, a whole course at a local university on branding. I do a lot of teaching seminars to business accelerators, that kind of thing, here in Cincinnati. So teaching is something I'm really comfortable with, really. I love doing it, and I've had some good feedback on it. And so when you offered that up, I thought, oh my gosh, I don't have a content around the real strategy of naming brands. I don't have like an hour-long piece of content around it. It would be super fun to put something like that together. And I think it would be helpful because, you know, short of hiring someone to name something, which is a very involved and expensive endeavor, how could I share it out to people? I could share around what I think are the strategic considerations they should keep in mind.
Great. Well, if you're interested in participating in a masterclass like that with Rebecca on the strategy of naming a brand, it might be naming a business, it might be naming a product within that business, or maybe you've got a training program like Rebecca talked about, and maybe there's a naming strategy for that to actually get it resonating with your ideal client, then leave us a review on the podcast and comment in either the blog post corresponding to this podcast, or you can go onto LinkedIn because there'll be posts on LinkedIn linking back to this podcast. And just let us know that you're interested in Rebecca's offer, and we'll keep you in the loop as to when we run that masterclass.
That would be great. I love it. Thank you for that, Jürgen. I think that could be a lot of fun.
All right. Now, what parting advice would you like to leave the listener today with, Rebecca?
Oh, my goodness. I've been bending your ear, and I guess theirs, on so much. I don't feel like there's anything that I've left unsaid that I wanted to get out.
So for me, I guess one of the highlights is just have the courage to go deeper, because it really informs a lot of brand strategy, as well as a whole lot of other things, like we were talking about niching.
Yeah, you know, okay, so of course I did think of something as you were saying that. I'm just always struck more and more and more by the fact that business branding of any kind, any scope or scale, and personal branding, the principles are all the same. So I guess I would just like to close that in everything we've been saying, you know, digging down for those truths, if you're thinking about, I often get the question, but how does that relate to personal branding? So preemptively, I will say it's all the same. Mm. It's, you know, truth is how you're going to differentiate and stand apart for yourself just as much as for your, you know, consultancy or your, I don't know what, supermarket chain or specialty bakery or whatever it is.
Mm. Yeah, wonderful. All right. Well, thanks, Rebecca. Now, finally, who else should I get on this podcast and have a conversation with?
I love that you ask people that, and I gave it a lot of thought. I know so many wonderful people that I was sort of like, ah, and then I realized the perfect person would be Eva Lutz. She's the principal and co-founder of a company called InnoG, kind of like Innova is. Inno, and then a capital G. They're a boutique strategy, design, and innovation consultancy, also here in Cincinnati. Eva and I started our careers both in the toy industry, and we've kind of, she's a designer, I was a marketer, but come around to now doing similar work. I have so much respect for who she is and so just the smart work she's doing. I think she would be a really interesting guest for you, really talking about design thinking and coming at innovation from that perspective.
Mm, wonderful. Well, we'll get an introduction to Eva from you and look forward to having her on the show. So thanks so much for sharing your time and your insights so generously with us today, and the all the process around digging deeper into why we do what we do and how that impacts on our branding. With us today, Rebecca, I've really enjoyed this. It's been fun chatting with you, and please do keep in touch.
Oh my goodness, I certainly will. Thank you so much, Jürgen. And listeners, dig down deep. Dig down deep.
Thanks.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that engaging and insightful conversation with Rebecca and took something away from her episode. There were so many valuable tips and ideas in what Rebecca shared, and I noted that her branding process has so many parallels with our marketing journey. I love her concept for digging for deeper truths to find both a powerful why and brand name or product name. I'm curious to know what you took away from Rebecca's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/Rebecca Arbona, Rebecca with one C. That's RebeccaArbona. Or lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Rebecca Arbona. You'll find more information about Rebecca there, as well as links to the Brand True website, her social media pages, and the other resources that we spoke about in today's conversation. Rebecca suggested that we have a conversation with Eva Lutz of InnoG on a future InnovaBuzz podcast episode. So Eva, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Rebecca Arbona. Tune in again to the next episodes of the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we've got more fantastic guests lined up, including buyer's agent Kitty Parker and strategy and innovation expert Rita McGrath. Thanks for listening to this episode. Make sure you subscribe to the show to be reminded of new episodes. It's free to subscribe. Leave a review if you like. Even if you don't like me, I'm okay with that. I'm asking you to leave a review because it helps other people find this show. Go to innovabiz.co to join our marketing transformation community and access a free gift my team and I made for you. It's the Marketing Master Mini Class. We want to give you everything you need to transform your marketing into a human-centered, relationship-focused growth engine. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.